Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us this evening Ken Jenkins, and Ken and one of his friends are going to be talking at the conference I'm going to be speaking at on Memorial Day weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of May, in the Santa Clara area. And, of course, if you're in the area and you'd be interested in coming, it's going to be a very interesting conference. If you want to know more about it, you can go to their website, which is conspiracycon.com. That's conspiracyconforconference.com. Or call them at 209-832-0999. And there's going to be people there from the right and the left, from the conservative, from the liberal, people who would probably disagree with one another on what the conspiracy is, although they all acknowledge the fact that there really is some sort of a mysterious force out there behind the scenes. Having gone to the websites and some of the people are going to be there, I can assure you it's going to be a fascinating, fascinating conference. I had the privilege of talking to Jim Mars this morning, who's going to be one of the speakers. And Jim, he's just your sort of guy, or my sort of fellow. He wrote Crossfire, the story of the Kennedy assassination, sold over 1 million copies. He wrote The Rule by Secrecy, which we carry. That sold 500,000 copies, his latest book of what really happened, talking about 9-1-1. HarperCollins had published his other books, made a fortune on them. They were all set to go. The book had gone through the legal department there, and then just before it was go to press, the final edition was ready, the final manuscript was ready. HarperCollins announced that they were going to let Mr. Mars keep all the money they'd given him, the advance, and they were going to give him back the copyright and the manuscript, and they wouldn't publish his book. Why? Well, I think that you probably can imagine why somebody doesn't want the truth about what really happened on 9-1-1 to come out. Right now, again, let me just give that telephone number. It's 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. If you're interested in knowing more about the conspiracy conference, the two-day conference. But right now, let's get to our special guest for the day, Ken Jenkins. Hi, Ken. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing just great. In fact, I was, I talked to Mr. Mars today, and he's talked about a lot of the things you and I have talked about. And obviously, somebody got to HarperCollins Publishers, one of the biggest publishers in the country, and I'm sure that the people out there, the people who really run things, the last thing they want is for the American people to question what we were told about what we saw that morning of 9-1-1 and the destruction of the Twin Towers and of the Pentagon. So, are you surprised at all one of the largest publishers would refuse to publish a book that told the truth?
Well, unfortunately not. Our media these days is amazingly controlled, and book publishing actually is one of the less totally controlled areas. I'm sure he'll find another publisher. But the big problem, of course, is broadcast television and the major newspapers who have such gatekeeping control over stories that there's been books written about that. Into the Buzzsaw is a book that talks about how major stories have been tried to be broken into the major media and stopped, and what happened to the people that tried.
Yes, in fact, we carry that Kristen Borgensen's book. We think it's a very important one. We've interviewed a number of the people she actually has. It's 18 essays by people who worked in the media, some of them Pulitzer Prize winner, others Emmy, had won Emmy's Prize And, of course, when they tried to tell the truth, all of them really believed that we had freedom of the press. And they suddenly realized freedom of the press means if you own the press, you have the freedom to print or not print whatever you want to.
Absolutely. And, of course, broadcast television is even worse that way.
It certainly is. Well, of course, actually, Monica Jensen Stevenson and Christine Borgensen were both in broadcast television. One was, both actually worked for 60 Minutes. And both of them, of course, lost their jobs because they wanted to tell the truth.
Right.
Well, anyway, why don't you tell our listeners your view of what actually happened on that morning? Because you and I know your friend there have been working to try to get the truth out through distribution of the deception dollar. And we can talk a little bit about that later. What is a deception dollar and why people might want to get one? But why don't you pick up this story, your view of what really happened on the morning of September 11th?
Well, of course, that's a big story, but briefly, there is a increasing amount of evidence that basically it was an inside job, that such an event could not have been put together by some people in a cave and some incompetent pilots, but rather as the most sophisticated act of terror in history, and therefore would more likely be coordinated as black ops normally are by CIA, Mossad, various secret organizations within our government and other governments, in order to be able to pull together an event of this sophistication. There's so many clues, it's hard to know where to start, but the biggest smoking gun that's always talked about, of course, is the stand down of the jets that are normal defense systems that routinely intercept any plane that is off course that doesn't report in as to what the problem is. They're routinely intercepted within 10 to 15 minutes response time. That's happened literally hundreds of times in the last 20 years, and the only time it hasn't happened was on 9/11 when four jets were off course. And for a considerable time, over an hour, and so somehow stand-down orders were given, and that could only come from very high within the military and defense systems, which immediately points, of course, very high into our government as to where the involvement might be. That particular clue is the biggest one, but it is one of literally dozens or hundreds at this point. I've lost count. I've been trying to amass a full list of all the evidence. It's now challenging because there's so many pieces of evidence now pointing to this being planned and executed using secret operations.
Well, you know, really so interesting, just an aside, you know, I do a lot of not only my own programs, but other programs on other people's networks and stations. And there was a gentleman from Syracuse who used to call regularly my programs. And whenever I would bring up this subject, well, he knew the commander there, you know, at Andrews Air Force Base or, you know, at the other Air Force Base. And they're just where he talked to them. He just didn't have any planes that were ready to fly, or they were just none of them had any fuel in them, or... And he would do this on my program, and what can I say? I don't believe you're telling the truth. Well, I'm retired Navy, and I know that fella, and I talked to him, and he told me, but I'm doing other programs, you know, some program book in Chicago. And how he knows I'm going to be doing a program in Chicago, I don't know, because it's an entirely different station. And here's the same voice calling in, putting out this same disinformation. And suddenly you have the realization that they're doing everything they can to neutralize what people say. Because, you know, if I say one thing and somebody says the other, the listener out there is sort of a little bit confused. And station after station after station, time after time, day after day, whenever I was on the radio, he was always calling in, wherever it would be in the America that I was calling in, to put out the disinformation. So they realize how important it is to use talk radio to confuse people and to counter what an effective host is saying, or at least I hope I was effective. Uh-huh. In fact, I was really rather flattered. They would think enough of me to have somebody who would follow me and know exactly where I was going to be and where I was going to be speaking, and then try to negate the point that you just made. Yeah. And that is, why were there no planes in the air? Oh, we didn't, and one of the things he said, why, we don't have planes that guard America. Our planes are all involved in guarding the country, you know, from incoming planes. But, you know, we don't have any planes guarding the nation's capital.
Yeah,
and I
so
said, you know, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. You mean to tell me, with all the money we're spending, we can't guard the nation's capital? Oh, we don't have enough money to guard every city in the United States. I should have talked about
New York and Washington, D.C. I mean, come on, if they're going to guard any city in the country, it's going to be D.C.
Well, I tell you that the other side isn't very smart. They would have had better arguments than that.
Right. But, well, what you're referring to, of course, is the incompetence theory, the idea that these kinds of things are due to incompetence. And part of the problem with that theory, besides the ones you mentioned, like our multi-trillion dollar budgets and so forth, is that it just doesn't add up. you have to assume all sorts of incompetence to organizations that are normally highly competent, and it's just there's a lot of holes in the theory.
Well, of course, the one theory is the FBI doesn't talk to the CIA, and the CIA doesn't talk to the FBI. And even though the CIA knew that these terrorists were here in the United States, why the FBI didn't know that the terrorists were here because the CIA hadn't told them. The only trouble is that the CIA did tell them about a couple of terrorists that were living in the United States, but the FBI couldn't find them, even though they were living with an FBI informant in Southern California, and one of them had his name in the telephone book. Come on now. Six of the nine of the terrorists were actually stopped on the morning of the attack, stopped in the airport, six of them because their names were on the terrorist list, and then the three others because they were with the people on the terrorist list, and yet all of them were allowed to get on the planes that morning. I wonder how many people out there in the audience have ever heard that. You know, the only reason I read six newspapers is because every once in a while, the truth does slip through, and any of our listeners that like to see that article, we'd be glad to get it for them. And it simply points out that nine of the terrorists were stopped at the airport for further questioning, and yet they were all released.
Oh.
And, of course, they knew, I mean, as of the 6th of August, the president had been told that the terrorists were planning on hijacking our planes. Now, you know, you would think that at that point he might have warned the airlines and had them reinforce the doors. It could be very easy just to put a bar there, or they could have armed the pilots. Actually, the pilots had the authorization to carry guns up until just a few months before that, when they suddenly discontinued that. In fact, I didn't know, but actually we had armed marshals on our planes until 1993, at which time Joseph Podansky had written a book called Target America, which said that the Islamic terrorists were planning on hijacking our planes, and that very year, why they discontinued the armed marshal program.
Yeah, and with the incompetence theory, of course, there have been no reprimands, no demotions, none of the kind of response you'd expect from the level of incompetence that they're claiming. That's one of the reasons that incompetence doesn't explain it.
Well, I think one of the most the significant things to me is certainly the people who knew about it beforehand. And they were told over and over, nobody could have known about it beforehand. But, of course, David Shippers was told by members of the FBI that the attack was coming on Lower Manhattan in early September. My friend Garth Nicholson was told that attack was coming on the Pentagon on the 11th of September. The FBI knew about it. But no FBI agent would dare come forward and make those statements. He might tell somebody else, you know, with a promise that his name would be kept secret. But if he, of course, came forward and told the truth, he would lose his job, he would lose his pension, he might even lose his life.
Yeah, and there were a number of FBI agents, of course, that did try to get evidence through and were blocked, and that's, of course, part of the evidence we have, that there was something going on, that multiple cases of various agents trying to follow up on various suspected terrorists and so forth, and their investigations were blocked.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and bring some of the facts that you know forward so that for our listeners, because they've probably heard most of my facts that we have, and certainly they're covered in my video on 9-1-1 contrived and the war in Arabia and other things that we put together based upon our research. But what have you come up with?
Well, I don't know if I can bring anything more than you haven't heard, but perhaps some things our listeners haven't heard. One of the things that I find interesting is Bush's reaction about the second jet hitting the World Trade Center. He apparently knew about the first one before he went into the photo op, and then as he was sitting there was told about the second jet. At that point, of course, everyone knew we were under a massive attack, and he just sort of nodded and then went on for another at least 25 minutes, or best reports, reading about goats with children, while, as he's, of course, the commander-in-chief, while our nation was under attack. I just doesn't make any sense that that would be the normal reaction of the commander-in-chief under those circumstances. And of course, again, nothing has been said about that. No sense of reprimand about that sort of behavior. So there's that. Part of what's convinced me most strongly, it took me many months of research before I became convinced of this. I'm a very questioning person, trained as an engineer, so I tend to be kind of analytical and look at all sides. And one of the things that really finally convinced me was looking at history. Throughout history, it turns out, there have been similar kinds of pretexts for war, fake terrorist attacks and so forth, lies and deceptions of various kinds to basically get the populace, which normally isn't all that in favor of war, to think that they're threatened and to get them fearful enough to support attacking another country. One of the best examples I found in my research was Pearl Harbor, which, of course, 9/11 has often been compared to. And it turns out the comparisons are a lot more than we first knew. Not only were we warned about Pearl Harbor, as we were in multiple ways about 9/11 from various countries and various secret services and so forth all over the world, giving a number of warnings. I think you mentioned that just briefly a minute ago. And in a similar way with Pearl Harbor, there were a number of warnings. That's been well documented. History Channel has a tape out on that. Came out, I think, in 98. We're shown on the History Channel. Talking about all the multiple warnings that went into Roosevelt and that were ignored. But the deeper evidence with Pearl Harbor that isn't in that particular documentary is that Roosevelt requested and received what turned from his two of his closest advisors, what turned out to be an 8-point plan to provoke the Japanese to attack, and basically putting them in an economic corner with sanctions and so forth, so that in order for them to continue on their path of conquest, they had to stop the U.S. from blocking them and had virtually no choice but to attack Pearl Harbor. So, of course, when the warnings came in, they ignored them because they were trying very diligently to get them to attack in order to get us into World War II and to get the nation, which at that time was strongly opposed to going to war in Europe again, to be willing to fight Hitler and the various things going on in World War II. So that was one example, Operation Northwoods, that I'm sure, you know about in great detail. It was another convincing thing to me, because here's a case where the Joint Chiefs of Staff presented to President Kennedy during the Cuban times a plan to make it look like Cuba had attacked us and therefore was, it would be justifiable for us to retaliate, and that included one of the possibilities was shooting down a plane and claiming that Cuba did it with U.S. citizens on board and killing U.S. citizens in order to get the populace behind an attack on Cuba. It turns out this pattern has repeated many times over and over, and there's quotes even from people like officers of Hitler's, how they know this, and it's a standard thing to get countries and people behind a war by faking terrorist attacks. And Gulf of Tonkin with the case of the Vietnam War, which was apparently didn't happen at all, but was again the pretext for a major ramping up of that war. So that pattern was really the thing of all the evidence that finally kind of pushed me over the top and said, okay, this is just one of those. It's a standard thing throughout history, and this is just the biggest and grandest of a pattern of events. Let's see, there's all sorts of funny things about the collapse of the buildings. The two World Trade Centers collapsed in a very suspicious way. Apparently no steel frame building has ever collapsed from fire. And now all of a sudden we have actually three buildings collapsing from fire in addition to the big towers that we're all so familiar with. There's a long list of questions about Building 7, a 47-story building nearby that also collapsed and was not hit by jets.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with Ken Jenkins, and we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ken Jenkins. He's going to be appearing at the conspiracy conference on the Memorial Day weekend. That's May 24th, May 25th up in the Santa Clara area. And if you want to know anything more about that, why, you can give them a call at 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999, and find out about it. But we're talking about just this basic a precedent that we've seen over and over and over again. I suppose we ought to call it a pattern that has been used to get our country into war. And for those of you who have any question about what Ken is saying, we have a new video. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story, Prelude to World War III. And, of course, there's a syllabus by the same name, which actually gives you the sources of documentation for everything that Ken is talking about. Certainly the fact that there was an 8-point program that President Roosevelt followed comes from a book called Day of Deceit by Robert Stinnett. And we actually have a 2-hour interview with Robert Stinnett. And the 8-point program was written by a Lieutenant Commander McCullum, and of course, who had lived in Japan, was ordered by the president to come up with a pattern, a plan on how they could get to Japan to attack the United States. And it's all right there. It's laid out point by point by point. And the president followed that. And of course, the real thing that forced Japan to attack the United States was the oil embargo. We put an oil embargo on Japan so she couldn't buy oil anywhere in the world. Now, what would happen if we had no oil and somebody put an oil embargo on the United States? What would the United States do? Well, we'd have to go to war, because, of course, you can't survive without oil if you don't have any. In the modern day, you know, Japanese industry, electricity, the whole society would collapse. And that's why we put an oil embargo on them. It was an act of war. We were already at war with Japan. They just never told the American people that. And, of course, we could then fast forward to what had happened on September 11th. I mean, after all, Osama bin Laden had actually engineered the attack, planned the attack, the Black Hawk Down attack in Somalia in October of 1994, the bombing of Riyadh, the American forces Riyadh in 1995, the bombing of the Khobar Towers in 1996, the bombing of our embassies in 1998, the bombing of the coal in the year 2000. And yet, according to a number of articles that have been published all over Europe, between July 4th and July 8th of the year 2001, just a few months, 2 months before the September 11th attack, Osama bin Laden was in the American hospital in Dubai, meeting not only with his family, but also, of course, with the station chief for the CIA there. Now, I actually have got that story not only from the reports that we find in Le Figaro, which was a French newspaper, but other newspapers I've read where other people had seen Osama bin Laden in the hospital in Dubai in July of the year 2001, just a few weeks before the attack. So I think that there's a great deal to suggest that this story is true, but you'll never hear that mentioned in the government investigation, because the president insists that he will direct what's going on there, that he appoint the man who's the head of the investigation to get to the truth. And if you think we're really going to get to the truth with the current investigation, I think you're sadly mistaken. And of course, if we never get to the truth, those people will have died in vain.
Yeah, and that's another of the major clues, looking at the official investigation and the various blocks and obstacles that have been thrown up by the administration, first not wanting any investigation, and then finally when the families of some of the people that died insisted, reluctantly agreeing to a limited investigation, and then appointing, of all people, Henry Kissinger to head it up, the biggest stonewaller on the planet. It's almost as if they're trying to tell us, you know, we're not going to let the truth about this come out. I don't think they could have been more blatant than putting Henry Kissinger in charge, who, of course, ultimately was disqualified and replaced with a fellow that's not much better in many ways. You know, these things are normally investigated up and down and one side and the other, and in this case, there's been so little investigation and so slow a response, and even a lot of the evidence has now been destroyed. Another of the clues that I think is strong is that normally, when any major structure goes down, there's an investigation. We want to learn about this, and And here we have a case where steel structured buildings fell from fire, which is apparently unprecedented. And rather than, you know, grabbing the scrap steel and looking at it and trying to analyze exactly why it could have fallen and so forth, all the evidence was carted away and sold for scrap, and even the investigators that were on the scene were blocked repeatedly from trying to you know, get any kind of meaningful information from the rubble. And everything's backwards in so many ways in this particular case from what would be normal. I was talking a bit earlier about Building 7, and of course there again, there's so many mysteries as to why that building fell at all. And again, all its all the remains were carted away, so one can't investigate and try to figure out what might have happened there.
But it's certainly, if you've ever seen pictures of Building 7 coming down, incidentally, that's covered in a video we have called The Great Deception. You will actually see the videos are coming down. It looked just like any building. It did not collapse from the middle like the Twin Towers. It collapsed from the bottom as if somebody had laid explosive charges at the bottom, and then it simply imploded under its own weight.
Yeah, it looked exactly like a planned demolition. If you've ever seen one of the videos that are out there that show buildings that are planned to come down, it looked exactly like a planned demolition. And that's yet another clue and a suspicious thing about why that building fell in the first place and why it fell in the way it did and so forth. There's a lot of questions about Building 7, and of course nobody even talks about that. Or the Pentagon, and there's another huge question area. There's all sorts of unusual things about the Pentagon hit to start with. It was hit with pinpoint accuracy from the point of view of the fact that it was hit in a part of the building where there were no high-ranking officers whatsoever. Part that had just been remodeled. It was hit right at ground level. There's no evidence of any vehicle, you know, touching the ground prior to hitting the building. It would be considered, I suppose, a perfect hit in a certain sense. And then the hole in the building doesn't seem to be big enough for a 67, whatever, which other jet it was, that was supposedly, Flight 77, that was supposedly hit the Pentagon. The hole doesn't seem to be big enough. The explosion doesn't seem to be of the right nature. There was no real, apparently no real evidence of the landing gear and the engines and the luggage and the passengers found in the Pentagon. There were some, I guess, small scraps of pieces that may have come from what maybe really hit the Pentagon, which would be more likely a cruise missile or some other kind of precision missile of that nature that could, you know, could be that accurate in hitting the building right where it would do the least damage to anyone of that they would consider important, high-ranking officers and so forth. There's a lot of questions about that Pentagon hit around that one.
Well, it's very interesting. I have a friend of mine who actually tracked down six people who saw a plane hit the Pentagon, and I actually contacted two of those people, and one of them was a Catholic priest, the other was, and I'm sure he was a Catholic priest because I kept calling the place where he worked until I finally got hold of him, which was a Catholic mission of some sort there in Washington, D.C., and both of them insist they saw a plane. Now, if no plane hit it, this is the one most cleverly conceived, cover-ups. We don't know, but there are a lot of questions. If no plane hit, what happened to the people who were on board that plane? I know I've talked to Stephen Push, whose wife was supposedly on the plane, and his remark is, if she wasn't there, what happened to her? And of course, supposedly they found forensic evidence of certain things that of hers in the rubble or in the ashes, or certain things were not incinerated. But who knows? All we know is what we're told, and I know Mr. Push is firmly convinced his wife was in the plane, and certainly there are a number of people who said they saw the plane hit the building. So, we will not know unless there's an investigation, and I can assure you, the way this investigation is set up, six people out of the 10 have to agree before anybody can testify. In other words, if anybody wants to come and tell the truth or raise a question, they will not be allowed to testify. And I would simply ask the question, if there's nothing to hide, why are they hiding it?
Yeah, it's like they've stacked the deck before the investigation even started. And
well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Mr. Ken Jenkins, and he's going to be giving a talk at the Conspiracy Conference. And of course, you may wonder out there, why should we even be worried about that? I mean, there are more important things to worry about than what happened on 9/11. Isn't that ancient history? And I would like to suggest that we never, of course, would have gone to war with Afghanistan had it not been for what happened on September 11th. And we would never have gone to war with Iraq because, of course, Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th and it had no weapons of mass destruction. But you have to understand everything was planned long beforehand.
Yeah.
And, of course, the next country, it would appear that we're going to war with, would be Syria. And for any of our listeners who doubt that this was planned long ahead of time by people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, I suggest you go to the www.newamericancentury.org website, that's newamericancentury.org website, and pull down their report on rebuilding America's defenses, and you will find, and I believe it's on page 51 of the report, but don't hold me to that, where they're talking about, of course, the whole report is about how America is going to rule the world. There's going to be a Pax Americana out there. There's going to be a change of everything. America is going to have its troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. And if the necessity for that transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. In fact, we're going to have troops stationed all throughout the world, like the cavalry on the old American frontier.
Yes.
But on page 51, it talks about, of course, we're not going to have the transformation of our military that's needed unless there is a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. Those are their words, a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. A catalyst is something you put into a chemical reaction to make it take place. And, of course, a catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor is an event like what happened on September 11th. And, of course, a member of this group that put together this report was Dick Cheney, who after the attack said, gee, we had information the attack was coming, but we never imagined it would have been anything like that. Oh, shucks, how could that have happened? Well, maybe, of course, if you go into the background of Halliburton, you'll understand that after the Gulf War in 1991, Halliburton, of course, was over there rebuilding the Iraqi oil wells and getting literally hundreds of millions of dollars from Saddam Hussein's government. And, of course, there are many people in Iraq, and we quote the book See No Evil by Robert Baer. Many people in Iraq believe, according to Mr. Baer, the United States kept Saddam Hussein in power, and some of them, and I'm just quoting Mr. Baer writes, some of them believe Saddam was on the CIA payroll. And if you'd like to get the documentation on that, if you haven't got a copy of my March newsletter, I think it was pretty good. I've had more comments on that than we've had in some time. So if you'd like a copy of my March newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Or it should be up on the Internet now at radioliberty.com. You can pull it down there free of charge and read what Robert Baer said. And we've simply quoted from his book. We carry the book. But you can actually get the most important parts just right off my newsletter. And every Iraqi that Robert Baer, head CIA agent in Iraq in 1995, every Iraqi he met said they believe the U.S. was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. Well, let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Los Angeles. Incidentally, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Jerry, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, hi, Dr. Stan. Hello?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. Really, Dr. Stan, I love listening to a lot of your programs, but this is, you know, this conspiracy theory about the trade towers being, you know, set up with explosives and, you know, it's just really a kooky conspiracy theory, and it just doesn't make any sense. As I watched it, the towers, they both came down very slowly.
They didn't. They came down real fast. 10 seconds.
No, because there's people from some of the top floors that, not the very top, just beneath the crashes that survived. And, you know, it came down very slowly, and there was, and I saw it live, and there were no explosion, evidence of any kind of explosion.
How do you know that? Because you saw it with your eyes, is that it?
Yeah, well, because, you know, explosion, things, fly out. There's,
I think you have a good point. There's no blatant evidence of explosions. Now, there is seismic evidence that indicates there may have been explosions prior to the fall, and that alone is very worth investigating. But the suggestion is that there were explosives in the building, and if they were set in order to bring those buildings down and make it look like it had to do the plane, well, of course they would do it subtly. This was obviously a professional job. And in that sense, I agree with you. I think they succeeded in hiding any such explosions that may have occurred. But those buildings were timed to have fallen in a little over 10 seconds were the best figures I saw. And if you run the equations for how fast something falls free fall in our normal gravity, 32 feet per second acceleration and so forth, you find that that is pretty much free fall speed. That those buildings fell pretty much unimpeded, and just time it. If you have a video that shows the fall, the figures I've read that seem to be reliable are around 10 seconds, and that's free fall.
I don't even really address the issue of the buildings coming down or why Building 7 came down. I think that's not the issue. I think that the one and the most important issue is that they knew that the hijackers were going to hijack our planes. And anybody who's read Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 18th of September last year, incidentally, that's our October newsletter, can tell that they had advanced knowledge that this was one of the things that was planned, and yet that morning there were no planes in the air. That is the issue that I would say. How do you feel about that issue, Jerry?
Well, I'm open-minded on that, and actually, I believe that that's possible, and that's the part I believe is possible. I don't know if it really did happen, but I think that because I believe we are trying to set up a police state.
Yes.
But the buildings came down in about a half hour. Were standing for about a half hour after they were hit by the plane.
Actually, closer to an hour. That's true.
Or yeah, maybe an hour. I don't know.
53 minutes and 101.
I
believe.
I think that basically what Ken was referring to was when, of course, whatever happened. At that point, they imploded very, very rapidly.
Yeah. Once they started falling, they fell at very close to free fall speed.
Well, I would say it's like a house of cards, because those buildings weren't meant to take that kind of a hit.
Right, but
and
normally,
then, you know, it's just like once the, you know, a high position floor falls, and the, it just has like a domino effect on all floors below.
But still, there's some resistance, and resistance should slow it down, and the time should have been a little longer. But I think Stan's point's a good one, too, is this is an unknown area, and there's so much actually stronger evidence, including the various warnings and the lack of defense. These are very strong pieces of evidence. And of course, in any kind of investigation, you look at who benefits. You know, who would benefit from this? And the supposed terrorists, Bin Laden and all these poor people, you know, got reverse benefits. They not only didn't claim credit, but they, claim they didn't do it, and they are now, of course, some of the most wanted people on the planet. This doesn't strike me as a benefit. The people that benefited from this are sitting in the White House. They got everything they wanted. They got everything they had planned from, Stan mentioned the PNAC, the Project for a New American Century. This is such a powerful clue if you read their documents that were posted and have been around since 97, 98 when that was established, or even dating back to 92 when documents were leaked from Paul Wolfowitz, one of their prime engineers of all this, where they had been planning preemptive attacks on countries such as Iraq. They were planning to increase the defense budget by the exact amount that it was increased years before 9/11. The Patriot Act was clearly written well before 9/11. It was not a response to it. All these things were lined up, ready to go. All they needed was their catalyzing event. And I'm one who can't possibly believe that people such as this, that belong to the PNAC and are now in the White House, who are willing to kill millions, hundreds of thousands of people in war to get their way, would be in any way opposed to killing a few thousand Americans to get their way as well. And I believe this is what happened. These people are determined to do what they have planned to do. Another piece of evidence, of course, is the book The Grand Chessboard by Zweig, where he also outlined this program for Pax Americana and world domination by the U.S. Years before any of this happened. And all they needed was this catalyzing event. And since they have planned and executed catalyzing events of this nature throughout history, it seems illogical to think that, well, the one time they get the perfect catalyzing event, this was the one that wasn't planned, and it was planned by some people in a cave and some really poor pilots who got really bad marks on their flights in little twin-engine planes, and then all of a sudden became pinpoint precision pilots at 500 miles an hour in jetliners. I don't believe it. I think those planes were remote-controlled, which supposedly they are capable of, and that they were flown with pinpoint precision because they were flown by computer.
Well, anyway, Jerry, your point is well made, and I think what the whole issue is, if we can get ourselves arguing about things which we cannot really be certain of one way or the other, I mean, there's some people who feel that there may have been explosives there. There are some people who, like yourself, feel, say, well, I don't believe that. I believe it was just inertia that brought the buildings down. And so we argue about that rather than arguing about the really important things. And
yeah.
So this is why I stay away from that issue. And I so I appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah, and I would also point out a plane is, if you look at it, it's a very 747 full of gases. I wouldn't like to stand in the way of that thing. That thing is it's like a missile with wings, you know.
It's true. It's a good missile. It's a good bomb, except the kerosene tends to burn at low temperatures, not hot enough to not only not melt steel, but not even particularly weaken it. And the kerosene was mostly blown out of the building, especially with the second hit. And so those fires, it's very suspicious how those fires could have weakened the building as much as it did. But Stan's point is such a good one. You know, why argue about these things that we're not sure of when we have so much evidence that we are sure of that points more directly at the fact that this was an inside job?
Okay, thanks very much. Anything else you want to say, Jerry?
Well, I have my, I would just end with this. I have my suspicions about the conspiracy, but you know, I wouldn't put my life on it.
Okay.
I have my suspicions.
All right, fine. Well, have you been to that project for the newamericancentury.org website?
Briefly.
All right,
I'll check it out again.
Okay, you go there and read this incredible document, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Actually, it's in my syllabus, my new syllabus, but you don't have to, of course, get the syllabus. You can just go up to the website and pull it down free of charge, okay?
Okay, thank
God bless you.
You.
Good night. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, you know, again, one of the things that really got me started thinking that things were not the way that I'd seen them on the morning of September 11th was a call from one of our listeners, and it was about 2 days after the attack. And he said, you know, Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, was called the night before, 8 hours before the attack, and told he should be very cautious flying on the following day, which was September 11th. And my initial response was, well, you know, that's all very well. You can say anything you want to on the talk radio, but I want you to prove that to me. So, you know, a couple of days later, you know, in the mail comes a full page torn out of the San Francisco Chronicle, and there's the story exactly as I gave it to you. And so not even wanting to accept that, called the mayor's press secretary and introduced myself, you know, coming from Radio Liberty, and he verified the entire story.
Yeah.
He said, however, this was not the first time we received one of these alerts. We'd also gotten one in July. Well, of course, now we find out that they had thought the attack was going to come, I think, on July 4th, and they'd told the people not to fly that day as well. And then, of course, on September 24th, the issue of Newsweek comments that high Pentagon officials canceled their flights for the 11th of September on the 10th of September because they had been told, too, the attack was coming on the 11th of September. So knowing that there was a question that there was going to be a terrorist attack somehow involving our planes, why weren't there any airplanes guarding our cities, guarding New York and Washington, D.C. on that very day? why were there no planes available? And I think there's only one answer is because somebody wanted the attack. Let's go to Mike, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. The other thing I just want to comment on that article in this Chronicle, it appeared only in one edition. Somebody pulled it out of all the other editions. Somebody either didn't put it up on the Internet or actually pulled it down off the Internet because we had a meeting shortly thereafter with Joe Farah, who is the publisher of WorldNet Daily. And I mentioned this to Joe, and he said, look, I said, I've spent hours going on the Internet, and that article was never printed because it wasn't on the Internet. And I reached in my pocket and handed it to him, copy, and I said, Joe, here's the article that wasn't printed that day. And, of course, then, it was covered by WorldNet Daily. Well, let's go to Mike calling from Santa Cruz. How are we doing, Mike?
Yeah, hi, Stan. You know, one of the most baffling things is that the Pentagon was so vulnerable that it could be struck that way by anything.
When it supposedly has a missile defense?
You'd think there was something that would prevent anything from
coming through. Yeah, it's only our most important military building, and supposedly, from what I understand, does have defensive missiles there at the, you know, to defend that building.
Mm-hmm. A couple other things. Regarding what Jerry was saying about the airplanes being the cause of the buildings coming down, and that, of course, you know, such a thing would cause the buildings to come down. In the days following the big event, there were televised interviews with the architects and engineers, and they showed all their models from back when it was built, their drawings, the steel skeletons. So there's an inner core of columns, and then there's the exterior series of columns that form the for the framework on the outside. They were completely baffled as to why the buildings came down.
Yes.
When they were designing and engineering those buildings, they actually took into account an airplane strike.
By a 707, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a comparable size jet.
Right. So they felt the building should have been prepared to take that sort of a hit.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, they did for 53 and 101 minutes, respectively. That's a long time to stand after such a hit.
Well, I watched those buildings come down on my TV, time after time after time, and from the beginning, the only thing I could think of was demolitions.
Yeah.
And,
well, see, but we don't know, and so we argue that point, and then, of course, we get away from the more obvious points, but you may be right, or Jerry may be right. But, see, what they've done is they've got us arguing over a point that we can't prove one way or the other. One we can prove is that they knew the attack was coming, and, of course, they did nothing to stop it. That, of course, is what's unconscionable. And, of course, that's perhaps why in Robert Baer's book, See No Evil, he points out that he had been told by a reporter who talked to one of the highest officials in the CIA that after the dust had settled, after September 11th, why the American people would realize that what had happened that day was a triumph for the intelligence agencies, not a tragedy. How could the death, or not a failure, how could the death of 3,000 people, Americans, be considered a triumph for our intelligence agencies? Why, we wouldn't be in war in Iraq if it hadn't been for that attack. We wouldn't be going to war with Syria and other countries if it had not been for that attack. We could not have changed the psyche of the American people had it not been for the attack. That's why it was a triumph, in my opinion. What do you think, Mike?
Well, they spent 4 months prior to that changing the psyche of the American people towards the Afghan people. Afghanistan had been our friend for so long, but for 3 or 4 months prior, we saw article after article, week after week, in the newspapers, telling us how horrible the Taliban was, especially regarding, of course, the usual stuff, the human rights, the treatment of women, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But
did they mention that we were the major financiers for the Taliban?
Of course not. But there actually was one article after 9/11 that spoke of bin Laden as having been a CIA operative.
Right.
Back during the Russian invasion. But now to my real question.
Okay, fine.
The question I've asked so many times when your guests come on, I'm still looking for corroborative evidence or answers. I wanted to ask your guest if he knows anything about what was going on in the FBI offices on the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th floors of, the South Tower. Those floors apparently were bombed out prior to the airplane strike.
Or prior to or after?
Prior. The chief head of security for the building was going up the elevator. He didn't know the building had been hit. The first tower was burning already, but there were calls for help from the 22nd floor because the 23rd floor had collapsed in on them. And he was going up to see what was going on and, of course, to help whoever he could.
Wow, that's a good one. I hadn't heard that. Stan, do you know about that one?
Well, I had heard that there was some sort of an explosion there in the FBI offices, 22nd, 23rd floor. And, of course, people went in there. And, of course, this is far below where the plane had hit. I don't know. It hit 70th or 80th floor.
Yes.
And, of course, they were totally destroyed. And this was... this was before the collapse of the building. So something had happened at that level as well. And, of course, it's been suggested there were some files there that that they wanted to destroy. This was a very effective means of making sure they were destroyed no matter what happened.
Well, the FBI was holding evidence against Alan Greenspan and Goldman Sachs and somebody else. Evidence was against them for gold price fixing. And it was looking pretty bad for the defendants.
Well, now, of course,
I had heard that part, yes.
Where is that written up, Mike? Do you have any of that written up someplace?
Yeah, I actually sent you a copy a while ago.
Well, why don't you send me another copy if you wouldn't mind?
Because I'll send a copy to your guest also.
All right,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I need some contact information.
All right, fine. Well, I'll tell you what, you can, we'll just, you can go, I'll put you on hold when you get off, and is it all right if Mike calls you at your number?
Sure.
All right, fine. So I'll have Herman give you Ken's number. How's that?
Mm-hmm.
After the program.
Okay.
Okay, and anything else you want to say, Mike?
No, that's all, thanks.
Okay, fine. All right, fine. Well, it should be, hopefully there a lot of people are going to want to come and hear what you have to say on the 24th or 25th. Do you speak now the 24th or 25th?
I'm on Sunday. That would be the 25th.
All right, fine. Well, I'm on, I think I'm on about 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. I hope I'm not on at 8 o'clock Saturday morning when there's nobody there.
Yeah, me too. No, I'm on at 10 on Sunday, so
all right, fine.
Looking forward to meeting you in person, Stan.
All right, fine.
I also want to make reference to, I think, the earlier caller who was so uncertain, to let him know, I think it's a book that you carry, The War on Freedom, is a good way to study this issue with a lot of documentation and backup to the claims being made.
And I think that this is a really an excellent book. It's written by a gentleman over in England.
Yes.
And he simply, actually, he has a lot. He stole a lot of my information, but that's all.
He did what I wish
I'd had the time to do, and he just cataloged everything that came from everybody and gave the sources of reference. And, of course, there's certainly the story of Mayor Willie Brown is a very important story because there were only a select few that were, for instance, notified. Mayor Willie Brown, a radical leftist, was notified, but other people, Barbara Olson, Ted Olson's wife, Ted Olson's the solicitor, Barbara Olson had written about a letter, a book on Hillary Clinton, a very uncomplimentary book about Hillary Clinton. And, of course, she was not notified. She was on, I think, the plane that went into the Pentagon, as I remember. And, you would think that they would have notified everybody. It was so interesting that somebody had bought up most of the seats on those planes so that there really were only about a quarter of the ordinary population on each one of those planes that you would expect. They were not fully loaded. Who bought up those seats? Who was it who had purchased stock options or shorts on the airlines, United Airlines and certainly J.P. Morgan, another thing in the European market? Certainly the people who were in charge of the market said obviously somebody had advanced knowledge and profited from that.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions on those stock put options. They were, I guess, traced to somebody in... was it Germany that had connections to the CIA
right.
before that investigation stopped? And, of course, the related thing after 9/11 with the anthrax thing, another investigation that was traced to Fort Detrick, Maryland, here in our country, before that investigation kind of ground to a halt.
Well, of course, what's really so interesting about that is on the evening of September 11th, 2001, when, of course, the flames were still licking at the rubble of the World Trade Center, Dick Cheney and his staff at the White House were started on Cipro, which is specific for anthrax. Now, if they thought there was going to be an anthrax attack, why didn't they notify the public? Why didn't they notify the American people? Why did they just protect themselves and start on a six-week course of Cipro?
Yeah.
And I think that's a question that nobody really wants to ask. But I will tell you, in my estimation, Dick Cheney is the man who really runs the White House, not a George W. Bush. I think that Dick Cheney controls the president almost as Colonel House controlled President Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And of course, in a wider range, you have Wolfowitz and Pearl and the people, all of which, you know, seem to be in pretty much agreement with what they're trying to accomplish. And so there's a kind of a nice committee of people that are probably much more in charge than Bush is.
And of course, those of you who remember that Dick Cheney had spent most of his life working in government, you know, going back to the 70s. He's the Secretary of Defense in 1992. He leaves government, and he has to go out and get a job to make a living. Where does he get a job? Does he get a job working at a major corporation so he can work his way up to... No, he goes in immediately as the CEO of Halliburton.
Yeah.
That immediately starts rebuilding Saddam's oil wells and other things. And you remember when Saddam was required to turn over this report on his weapons of mass destruction? Well, it was a 12,000-page report, and our government censored 8,000 pages of that because it pointed out how many of American corporations had actually, helped. And, of course, not just American, but French and German corporations had helped Saddam build up his military capacity and his weapons of mass destruction. And most Americans do not know that Iran is suing the United States today for the fact that we helped Saddam Hussein use poison gas on their troops. And, of course, continued supporting the wicked Saddam Hussein after he had used poison gas in total violation of every international law.
Yeah, there was no reprimands for him during that time for his or against the Kurds. It's like that was okay and overlooked.
Well, we're just about out of time. What are your thoughts that you want to leave with our listeners, and why should they come to want to talk, listen to your talk on the Sunday morning there at the Conspiracy Conference?
Well, basically, it's important to question these things. Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns, and we're not certain about many of these things, but the important thing is to question, to look, to read, and to look at the alternative sources that are available and radio programs like yours so that they can get the real news, because they're not getting it from their TVs. Shut that thing off. It's pretty much worthless other than maybe Bill Moyers. Get on the internet and read and see for yourself what you think's going on.
And don't even trust Bill Moyers. Anyway, thanks very much for being with us. It's a real pleasure. We're looking forward to being with you there on the 24th and 25th of May, there Memorial Day weekend. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Bye bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time when I have to just mention that Radio Liberty is listener supported, and we do hope that many of you out there who listen to our programs will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we try to reach out across America with the news behind the news, the story you're not going to get elsewhere. And we do this 5 hours every day, hoping that
we can
make people understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. And if you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, why, go ahead and give us a call, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. And, of course, pray for our boys over there, who I believe are soon going to be sent into battle once again. And lastly, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, for we're moving into World War III. There's only a few voices here that are telling you what's happening. Till tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night. May the Lord be with you. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, if it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring, I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and just one quick comment on what we were talking about during the last hour, and that is that they will come up with so many side issues to throw us off the track. And one of the major side issues talking about what happened on 9-1-1 was the attack on the Pentagon. Was it a plane or wasn't it a plane? Some people insist it was a cruise missile. Some people argue that, there was a small commuter plane that crashed into the end of the building. There are all sorts of things that people will argue about. There are books. There are pictures up on the website. There's a French book that's come out saying that no plane that hit the Pentagon. And what they can do, and this is all planned ahead of time, what they do is they get you arguing on all sorts of side issues so you don't address the real issue. And you put so many facts out there, people end up getting so confused they don't know what to believe. And then they turn off. They're playing games with our minds. And once you understand that, then everything makes sense. Well, right now, let's get to our special guest from the Sacramento area, Randy Thomason of the Campaign for California Families. Here's Randy.
Dr. Stan, hello to you.
Good evening, Randy. Tell us what's going on in Sacramento and what we should be concerned about and what those scoundrels are doing to the people of our state.
Well, Dr. Stan, good to talk with you again. The legislature of California is on spring break. I wish they call it Easter break, but they don't really want to acknowledge Easter, so it's spring break or spring recess, and they aren't going to come back till next week. Now, today being tax day, isn't it amazing? April 15th is here again. But, we have to pay some taxes, but I think we're taxed way too much. Don't you think so, Dr. Stan?
Oh, no question at all. But, of course, you know, what's going to happen if they get far less in income tax than they'd anticipated? Then what are they going to do there in Sacramento?
Oh, it's going to be increases of the tax increases will go even higher than Governor Gray Davis wants it, for example. The governor has been proposing $8 billion in tax hikes, and it's probably going to go up. I mean, Gray Davis is not one that you can call conservative by any means. He has only been pushed in that corner if he's been very afraid and very pragmatic. But most of the time, he has been a tax and spend Democrat, and that's why we're in the pickle that we're in right now. If you want to push jobs and businesses out of the state of California, you'll raise taxes. You can never help an economy by taxing more of it. You'll simply worsen the situation. According to the National Tax Foundation, California's taxes are fourth highest in the nation when you consider state, federal, and local taxes per capita. Fourth highest in the nation. It could even get higher if the Democrats get their way in Sacramento.
But are they going to? Aren't the Republicans going to hold tight, or are they going to buy off some of the Republicans there?
Well, you'd hope that history would not repeat. In past years, both Gray Davis and his predecessor, Republican Governor Pete Wilson, have been able to pick off weak Republicans who will basically prostitute themselves and join with the tax and spend Democrats to form a two-thirds majority to pass a tax and spend budget. However, it seems that the Republicans, I think they're pretty united in not on moral issues, but on the anti-tax message. So I think on the direct taxes, the Republicans will hold firm in Sacramento, but on some other issues, they'll won't be quite as united. Of course, the Democrats, in comparison, are united in wanting to raise taxes and nearly united in a lot of issues such as undermining marriage.
Well, you know, there's an article I read the other day in the Santa Fe Mercury, which really has some excellent articles. It was talking about the head of the Democratic Party there in Sacramento, and he was having to actually back away from some money he had been giving to consultants, to ex-members of the legislature. One of them was a Democrat who was getting $100,000 and for some a non-specific job.
Right.
And another was a Republican. It just happened to be the Republican who sold out his party a couple of years ago so they could raise taxes. And he was getting $114,000 for a full-time job. When, of course, the head of the Democratic Party found out, he also had another full-time job as an instructor at a university where he was getting paid a full salary. So he was going to cut him to half a salary. Now, this is a Republican who had sold out the people of the state of California, and the Democrats were going to give him a job at $114,000 a month. $114,000 a year, I'm sorry, why would they give that money to a Republican? Could it be a payment for services rendered? Is this how our system really works, Randy?
Well, when you're talking about this, that Democrat leader is Assembly Speaker Herb Wesson, who you're talking about,
right.
And he calls himself the pizza man because he delivers. I guess he gives a little pizza topping to others who will deliver for him, and that's why he was over the top, if you will, by handing over government money to people who shouldn't be getting any because they weren't really doing anything. I mean, it's just cronyism. It's special deals, but it's going against what is right for the government. How can you say, well, we want to have good government when this corrupt stuff is special favors is going on? There's more of this that needs to be exposed, and hopefully there'll be more of that. I do want to say briefly, maybe you've seen the latest about Gray Davis's low poll numbers. As we want integrity in government, most people, Republicans, Independents, and Democrats, do not see Gray Davis as having integrity. The latest from the Field poll, which basically says that only 24% of registered voters approve of Gray Davis' job performance. 65% of California registered voters disapprove of Gray Davis' job performance. This is according to the Field poll, which is, in my opinion, one of the most unreliable polls in the state. However, in this case, it's reliable in the sense that it's going to reflect that an incredible amount of Californians want Gray Davis out. And there are other polls which have even higher numbers. And so when the Field poll says 65% of California voters dislike Gray Davis' job performance, the liberal media all perks up and thinks, well, this must be at least this many. One distinctive of this poll says that most of the voters they surveyed said they would vote to remove Gray Davis from office if given the option. Of course, that means if the recall election qualifies. So that's Gray Davis can't be feeling good today.
No, I feel, that's too bad. I feel sorry that he doesn't feel so good today.
Maybe he'd feel better if he got a real job or something. but in any case, the recall election effort is going forward, and I think the low poll numbers will motivate more people to go to websites like DavisRecall.com.
That's DavisRecall.com?
Actually, it's DavisRecall.com, and there's a second site called RecallGrayDavis.com, and these sites are where you can actually sign the petition. I know people who today were signing the petition in front of the post office before they were putting forth their tax returns in the mail.
So you can either be a Republican or a Democrat and still sign that petition.
Right, a registered voter in California. That's all you have to be. And again, DavisRecall.com is a great site to go to. Dr. Sandin, our remaining moment, I want to mention something. This is midweek here. Next Monday, there's likely to be a vote on a terrible bill that would impose $300,000 in government penalties against Boy Scout councils, Bible bookstores, and any business that refused to hire a transsexual applicant. This bill, AB 196, is obviously an attack upon religious freedom and pushing penalties upon any person who did not roll over to the transsexual drag queen agenda. We need people to contact Governor Gray Davis on this one and your state legislators. It's AB 196. It's a bad, bad bill. And please contact the governor. His phone number is 916-445-2841. Urge the governor to oppose that bill and call your state assembly member, whether it's John Laird at 916-319-2027 or Simone Salinas, 916-319-2028.
Why don't you give all those three numbers again, Randy,
okay,
so people can, if they want to write them down, they can.
Yes, and I'm speaking for the to call the governor. His phone number is 916-445-2841. Or the assembly members representing the area where Radio Liberty emanates locally, Simone Salinas is a Democrat. His number is 916-319-2028. John Laird is a colleague of his in the assembly from Santa Cruz area. John Laird is 916-319-2027. And also a little north in the Campbell area, of just north of Santa Cruz, is Rebecca Cohn. Her phone number in the state assembly is 916-319-2024. Please call these politicians and urge them to oppose AB 196. This bill attacks the Boy Scouts and religious freedom with huge government fines if they don't hire transsexuals. It's very intolerant. It's funny how the most tolerant people are they claim to be tolerant, but they push this intolerant junk. It's truly amazing. But we have a chance if enough people expose this bill and there is a concerted outrage. For more information, please visit our website. SaveCalifornia.com has all the information, more phone numbers, and a church flyer that you can get into other people's hands.
Well, the question I have is, how did Senator McPherson vote on that bill?
Well, it hasn't been to him yet.
All right, fine.
It's originated in the Assembly. We hope that he won't get a chance to see it in the Senate.
All right, fine. Randy's recommendation, you want to get us your telephone number and your website?
Yeah, the website again is SaveCalifornia.com, SaveCalifornia.com. And it's there where you have all the phone numbers and all the contact numbers for the legislators and for Governor Gray Davis and that church flyer to get into other people's hands. I'll just give that website again one more time, SaveCalifornia.com. That's where you can go to get involved and to learn about this bill and other bills and take action. You know, with the recall effort against Gray Davis, people's rising anger, I'd say there's a wave coming in California. Let's all be part of it. We need renewal in the state, and we need people to do something as small as lifting up the phone and making a phone call. Let that be the first step of repentance.
God bless you. Thanks so much, Randy.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Let's go to Brad. Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Oh, doing great, Dr. Stanley.
So tell us what the good news is.
Well, the good news is sort of tough to say the good news on this side of the story, but it's actually pretty much a challenge, I think, to many people who are going to hear it, and that is, as many people are aware, there was the National Day the Day of Silence that was instituted by GLSEN, the homosexual organization, and what we had is children, and kids in middle school, high school, who were told and intimidated by many activists to be silent in support of homosexuality. The problem is that it didn't stop there, Dr. Stanley. So what happened is we had teachers and schools who were signing off on this, supporting this, treating it like it was like a national holiday. And we have one example of one case, for example, in the Sacramento area where a child wrote a had a T-shirt on expressing his perspective, and the you know, the pro-family perspective, and he had the shirt ripped off of him, as a T-shirt actually ripped off of him, by these quote-unquote tolerant people recognizing this day of silence for homosexuality. And so we also had other examples where teachers would actually be quiet and silent and not even teach in order to support this pro-gay gay movement.
Well, I think a teacher has a perfect right to do whatever they want to, but not on school grounds.
Right.
They can do that off ground, but if they don't work that day, they ought to be fired. And
absolutely.
When they're using their position to push a political agenda, that is unconscionable.
Absolutely. Well, what we did is we went ahead and sent out some letters to some school districts, letting them know very clearly on the record that if there's any intimidation by any outsiders to or the teacher or the administration, any intimidation regarding kids who don't agree with this agenda, any hostility, any harassment, then we'll hold them accountable and we'll take them to court. And so we sent out this announcement on a press release, basically letting everyone up and down the West Coast know that there's any incidents at all that's happened where students were harassed and the school didn't take appropriate actions, or the teachers engaged in harassment, which is not too uncommon, unfortunately. I want them to contact us at the Pacific Justice Institute so we can investigate it and hopefully be able to challenge it and make these school districts know that there's a price they have to pay when they so egregiously breach the trust of parents by such hideous and outrageous conduct.
All right. Well, now, what day was the day of silence and what happened that day?
Oh, it was last week. It was last Wednesday and that it took place. And it was reportedly in over 1,200 schools across the country. Now, you know, to varying degrees, but we know that there's school districts that were more complacent about it, others that were much more openly supportive, like in Sacramento, for example, openly supportive of it. And the bottom line is that parents need to realize that there is something that they can do about this. School districts can be sued if they participate in activities that amount to harassment of kids because of their religious convictions and background on such days. And there's also incredible opportunities that parents have to be proactive with providing more positive role models, like happened at Mesa Verde High School, where there was a revival rally with an ex-gay giving his testimony with a youth evangelist. So there's actually proactive things that can happen as well, and we at the Pacific Justice Institute are willing to work and serve anywhere is necessary to help people do that.
No, of course, my feeling is that any parent, Christian parent, that loves their children, or any parent, Christian or not, that loves their children, would get them out of the government schools and
right.
get them someplace where they can bring them up in the ways of the Lord.
Right.
Wait, anything else you want to do? You would like to get out your telephone number and your website?
You bet. Thank you very much. It's our telephone number is 888-305-9129. That's 888-305-9129. And our webpage, which has some incredibly interesting information, our case updates, etc., that's it's simply at pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org. And we do all of our work without charge, thanks to many of your listeners. And we're here to serve, and so just give us a call if we can help you.
All right, fine. Thanks very much, Brad.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay,
bye-bye.
Fine. That was Brad Dacus. And let's see, is anybody on line six here? Or Randy, are you there? I'm going to just drop line six, and maybe we can put our next guest onto line six, Herman, in case we have any calls. So if we could put our next guest on line six, we get him, and hopefully we can go from there. The next program is, I was just going to be talking about a program put out by the American Evangelistic Society, and you may or not be interested in it, but it's an interesting concept. It's called MediShare, and it's supposedly where Christians are helping Christians. Now, supposedly, this is a very, very good program. I know that our producer this evening knows this gentleman and speaks very, very highly of him. So without further ado, let me introduce our guest here from MediShare. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You bet. Dr. Stan, I'm sure glad to be here.
All right. Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about this? Our guest is Joe Foreman, and he's going to be talking about MediShare. How long has MediShare existed? How long have you been with it? And just tell the story.
Sure. Okay. Well, Doc, actually, this concept began in the 1950s. The American Evangelistic Association was doing this program, but just on a private basis for their own pastors and missionaries. And then in 93, it was open to the general Christian public, as long as we could get a signature from the applicant's pastor vouching for their biblical lifestyle. And so from 93, it's just really grown and burgeoned. And then the whole concept is, why should we Christians be subsidizing lifestyle abuse? You know, estimates do vary, but a lot of estimates are that 80% of all claims that are occurring, medical claims, are lifestyle abuse. And it's not just tobacco, you know, drugs, alcohol, AIDS, sexually transmitted, but there's other things. But as Christians, if we're walking with God and exercising stewardship properly over our bodies, we should not be involved in these sorts of things. And so Christians are feeling that it's really not stewardship to pay into the common, into the just general secular pool where we will be forced to subsidize these things. So for this reason, we've come together over the last 10 years, especially. It's really burgeoned, and we're now at about 45,000 individuals, over 14,000 families. We have our people in all 50 states and in about 80 countries of the world. And the basic idea is, again, bringing Christians together to use the biblical concept to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ, and also to teach and encourage one another to use biblical stewardship over caring for our bodies, because we are not our own. We're bought with a price, and therefore we should be glorifying God in our bodies. So that's our basic vision, is to help Christians with stewardship and bring them together to take care of one another and honor God by the way we use our money and our bodies.
All right, fine. So how does this system work?
Okay, we have a, well, we've got a home office in Florida. They're Melbourne, Florida, and there we have about 40 employees. And then we have another, what we call our processing office in Illinois. But every family sends their share each month, just like clockwork, on the first of the month. Most of our members are full families of three or more, but we have couples and singles as well. And for a single person, regardless of age, Dr. Stan, it's just $120 a month. And then for a two-person family, which could be a husband and wife, or a single parent and child, it's $230. That's $230. And then for a family of three people or more, it's $297 a month, and again, regardless of age. And what they get for that is we have a sharing program where the individual member, if he has a sickness or accident, he would face the first $250 on his own. And so you could call that a deductible. So after the first $250, then the program takes over, and the sharing of the members covers everything from there to $5 million.
All right. Now, of course, the program then picks up, and you don't have to put anything additional in over that amount of monthly payment?
That is correct. Yes, that is the monthly share, and we actually have two different programs, but the main program, I mean, the main option that people take is the $250 deductible.
All right, fine. And so then that includes the hospitalization, doctor's visits, the whole thing?
Yes, we're pretty comprehensive in what we care for. We take care of hospital and surgery, but also doctor's office visits if you're sick or hurt, including lab, x-ray, diagnostic tests, and prescriptions.
But, of course, things are just so prohibitively expensive today. Even the medicines are prohibitively expensive. How can you afford to do that?
Pardon me, what was that last question?
How can you possibly afford to do that?
Yes, okay, well, you know, people do ask us. They say, well, Joe, you know, we're 55, and we still have a few children under the roof, and we're paying $900 a month or $1,000 a month. I met a family the other day that was paying $1,600 a month, and that is happening. And in fact, some of these denominational programs that pastors are in, many of those are well into, $1,200, $1,300, $1,500 a month. And much of it, of course, is you know, when we talk about lifestyle abuse, there are several different facets of that. You know, it's not just the tobacco, drugs, alcohol, but it's also and pastors get into this second area, just as anyone else does, and that would be living on a refined processed food with no fiber and high in sugar, empty calories, and things like that, bringing on the excessive weight gain and diabetes type 2 and, you know, heart disease and so forth. Now, it's not like we're perfect, but we really lift up a standard in this area. First of all, the only people that can join our program are born-again Christians that do not use tobacco and do not abuse alcohol and who do attend church regularly and live a moral lifestyle, and they have to have a pastor vouch for them for their biblical lifestyle.
What happens if they have a pre-existing condition like diabetes, back injury, something of that sort?
Okay. pre-existing conditions are not covered until they are reversed. There are some conditions, for example, type 2 diabetes. We have had a lot of success in helping people reverse that. Now, if someone comes to us and wants to join our program and they already have type 2 diabetes, then, of course, type 1, you know, child onset, juvenile onset is actually a different disease, as we know. We don't know how to reverse that one yet, and maybe we never will be able to, but type 2, what we do is we tell people you can join as soon as you've reversed that condition, and we will give you information that will help you do that.
And how do you reverse the type 2 diabetes?
Type 2 diabetes basically is getting back to a strict diet of high fiber, plenteous in vegetables, and I'm not the expert myself on that, but it includes vigorous exercise and some weight loss. And we are seeing many, many people reverse type 2 diabetes.
Well, now, how do you teach them to do that, and who does the teaching as far as that?
Okay. Well, we have a wellness department, and unfortunately, I'm not as trained as those folks. We all try to be into nutrition as much as we can, but, there are a lot of principles of health there. Basically, getting back to natural foods, whole grain, refusing to eat the processed white flour, refined type things, which burn to sugar too quickly, as far as I know, and again, I'm not the nutritionist, I'm not a member of the wellness department, I'm just out here as one of the regional elders, but we are seeing people getting into a real high fiber diet with a lot of vegetables and proper amounts of protein and vigorous exercise, drinking lots of water, and we're seeing people lose weight and strengthen their bodies until they are able to, eventually a doctor will declare them as being, free of diabetes and not diabetic anymore. So,
well, do you have any sort of a pre-joining physical examination does the doctor have to go over the patient before you accept them into the program?
Okay, we do not use a pre-application physical. We do ask that people fill out an application with medical history. And then we do look at that. The way we are set up is we do have an insurance company that we have contracted with to take the top end because, we have, like I say, over 14,000 families, and we take care of the first 50,000 of anything that would happen to one of our members. But then if it goes over 50,000, then the insurance company does step in, and they guarantee that from 50,000 to 5 million.
Okay, fine. So that's
and pretty so we cool. And then the reason I'm heading there is just to say that we have to go by their underwriting guidelines, because when we bring someone in the program, we actually put them at risk as well.
All right, fine. We'll be back in just a moment with Joe Foreman. We'll welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we have with us Joe Foreman from MediShare, and we'll of course take your calls, welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY if you have a question or comment about this. And of course, one of the things about the cost of medication. Now, they have intensely boosted up the cost of medication here in the United States. I was told today that some of the drug companies are writing to pharmacists in Canada or in Mexico and threatening them there if they dare sell medicines at reduced rates to Americans. Now, they boosted the prices up 4 or 5 times what they ought to be. This is a conspiracy and restraint of trade. The medications that I used to buy at $5 a vial, you know, and of course now they've gone out of patent and no longer covered by patent. They're $30 or $40 now for exactly the same medicine, and this is just in a relatively few years. So there's an organized effort to create a crisis in healthcare delivery to force American people into a socialized medicine. And just as the Vietnam War was used to bring the Great Society socialist programs to America, with Medicare and Medicaid and welfare and the National Endowment for Arts and Legal Foundation and all of these foolish things that really many of them are very, very dangerous things. So the current war is going to be used to further this move towards a socialist America. I really believe it's going to result in the establishment of a universal health care. That's always been the goal. And, of course, they have to create a crisis. They've done a good job of running the health care costs up so high, and now they're trying to push up prescription medicine. So what about prescriptions? How do you handle the prescription part of this, and providing the medicines for your clients?
Okay, we do participate in the prescriptions, but with prescription, and of course it will be reimbursed at 100%, but people do need to buy their prescriptions and then turn in the receipts to us.
But you don't have any program by which you actually provide the medicines for them, which you probably could do at a cheaper rate than paying what the pharmacists are
yes, Dr. Stan, we are working on that very thing, and we don't have that just yet. That you're kind of referring to mail order?
Right, something like that, or phone-in order, something like that.
Yes, we are working on that. It's probably within this year, we believe it will be up and running.
All right, fine. Mm-hmm. Well, now, of course, as the cost at the hospitals, of course, skyrockets, and, of course, what happens, as you well know, is that the hospital costs are intensely jacked up. Why? Because Medicare doesn't pay the cost, Medicaid doesn't pay the cost, and, of course, the hospitals are now forced to, anybody who comes there and says, I don't have any money, but you take care of me, and they're forced to take care of all these people. So the hospital has to break even. So they raised up artificially the price for the people who are paying the insurance payment of their bills. So you must really get some bills that, you know, $50,000, $100,000. And I think the last time I went to the hospital, it was something like $16,000. I didn't even get a meal. I mean, I couldn't believe it. So, I mean, how do you handle these exorbitant charges? And I'm a physician, so I was horrified to see what they were charging patients, when they would go in, even for an outpatient surgical procedure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, doctor, there's not a tremendous amount that you can do once our members do get admitted to a hospital, and so our first defense is obviously to try to keep our members healthy enough so that they don't need to use a hospital, obviously. So, but, you know, it is going to happen. I mean, people have accidents and things like that, and, of course, now we do dicker with the hospitals and do try to win the discounts, and we have become fairly effective at that. But let me just share something with you that's very exciting. As far as how do we handle this exorbitant cost of hospital and these big surgeries and so forth. Here's one example. You know, when someone is with a secular insurance program, Blue Cross or whatever it would be, and if they come down with chest pain, they go to the cardiologist and he says, he checks them out and he tells them, well, you've got, you know, 95 or 99% blockage in an artery or two, and you're not going to make it without the $100,000 heart bypass. Well, you know, with secular insurance, there's no discussion on that. You just go ahead and $100,000 later, you have yourself a temporary cure. Now, with MediShare, with our program, we can pay for a heart bypass. That's not a problem because of the way we're set up. There is the money there. However, there are very few heart bypasses occurring in our group because of several factors. One, obviously, we've addressed earlier. We are trying very hard on an educational effort to get people educated to not eat and live that way that's going to induce that. But as you know, you can't force everybody to live that way. So there are people who are coming down with chest pain. So what happens? They call in to our 800 Ask First line and register, and we get back to them, and once we find that they're not in immediate danger, if they're willing, and most of them are now, we send them to a lifestyle nutrition center, of which there are about 10 of them around the country. They're all owned and operated by independent groups of Christian MDs who are quite contrarian to the establishment medical as being operated here in America. And they're taking people, Doc, who could not walk around the flagpole twice without chest pain when they arrived, and 3 weeks later they've got them walking 4, 5, 6 miles a day with no chest pain. And what they've done is they put them on a very strict, high-fiber, vegetarian diet, and they get them exercising daily under the supervision of an exercise physiologist, and they just make phenomenal progress in thinning out that blood in just 3 weeks. And then, of course, we insist on the wife going along with the heart attack patient there so that she can take the cooking classes and learn how to save her husband's life and maintain his health through the cooking of nutritious and delicious food. So it's a whole man concept, and we do that for about $6,000 or $7,000 to send the couple to a lifestyle nutrition center for 3 weeks.
Well, now, if one of the partners, either the husband or the wife, were to come down with diabetes, would you send them to that sort of a center as well?
Yes, we would, and we have the same type of a program there, and they're having excellent success in reversing that diabetes, as I mentioned earlier.
Well, now, do you know what the clinics would be here in California that would qualify?
There is a world-famous Weimar Institute there in California, and I've never been there, but I've seen a few pictures, and it's pretty awesome, and they have quite a reputation for reversing cancer, reversing diabetes, and reversing heart disease.
And we've had friends who've gone there and certainly have spoken very, very highly of the Weimar Institute, and I believe that's in Southern California. So anyway, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Mr. Foreman, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, what about the concept of having your members pray for one another?
Obviously, that is extremely important. And, you know, if you are reading the papers much, it just seems like, you know, almost every month or every other month you'll see an article in even the secular media that comes out with a report about how people who get prayed for some reason, the secular folks just can't quite figure it out, but they're making better recoveries. So obviously God answers prayer, God hears prayer and answers. And so that is a big concern. And every month when we receive our monthly share, we receive the name of the person where our share is actually going to. Now, actually, we all send our monthly shares to a central location because there have been other programs, Dr. Stan, that where, you know, you were informed, okay, you send your share this month to this person over there in Ohio, or next month it's this person in Nebraska, but that was a nightmare on accounting, and so we send our share to a central place, but we are told what person and what malady they had that, well, actually we don't mention the malady, we do mention that this person was sick or hurt, and your share this month is going to pay their need. And so then we pray for that person, and we can send them a card and let them know that we're praying for them.
Well, now, what do you do as far as people on Medicare? You accept people over 65 or
yes,
with all others? But, you know, almost everybody over 65 literally is forced to go into Medicare because they can't buy insurance elsewhere.
That is true. It, you know, as I often tell people, you know, the worst possible age out there to be is 60 to 64. That's where the insurance rates are horrible, and yet you're not on Medicare. Once you're on Medicare, you're kind of home free, at least from the premium standpoint, because obviously the government steps in and becomes your stop-loss carrier, so to speak. So, but yes, we do have our members, you know, stay with us if they wish when they turn 65. It's just that at that point, we do, our program is constructed on the basis that we know that everybody's, pretty much everybody's paid into Medicare and Social Security, so our program is predicated at that point on them being in the Medicare coverage from the government, and then we come in and we take care of what the government doesn't take care of.
Well, what happens if somebody is, let's say, 75 and they have Medicare, but they'd rather be with you than be with Blue Cross as a supplementary insurance? Do you still take people in, or do they have to be in before 65?
Yeah, no, we do. You know, we don't cover pre-existing conditions until they're reversed, of course, and we encourage people to do that. But as you know, people 70 and 75 are quite often, and there's the unusual one, isn't there, but quite often they're going to have several pre-existing conditions. But we do accept them if they can pass normal underwriting, and then, of course, the government will be the basic coverage for them, but we will come in and take care of the things that the government, Medicare, does not.
All right.
So we do accept, you know, even an application from an 80 or an 85-year-old.
Well, now, what about the having to raise your rates as time goes by? Certainly, what we're seeing today, you know, it's just almost runaway health care prices, of course, as a direct result of government interference, the lawsuits. Certainly, the government is making it as difficult as they can for doctors and doctors. I can remember when I first went into practice, we were charging $4 for an office visit. And I can remember when we went up to $5 for an office visit, and I was an orthopedic surgeon, you know, and I was a specialist. And yet, and now today, you're talking to the doctor's office, $100, and the doctor's losing money because of, you know, all the rules and regulations and paperwork and
malpractice
and all these things that just make it so totally impossible for the average doctor, you know, to make a living today. And I would tell you, more and more doctors, good doctors, are getting out of healthcare. There's shortages of nurses. You know, you have difficulty getting nurses. They're having to bring in foreign nurses into our hospitals and foreign doctors into the system. And there's no problem facing America today that a new government program won't make worse. So, but of course, it would appear that this whole thing is just ready for implosion. Medicare will soon be not taking in, it'll be putting out more money. There'll be no money. There is no money in the fund. We've already spent that. But of course, they'll be actually putting out more money than they're taking in, and then the government's going to have to start subsidizing that as well. And you know, this whole thing, I'm very, very concerned about the future of healthcare in this country.
Yes, just to address some of your thoughts there, we obviously are witnessing a tremendous medical inflation in this country, and it's not just the explosion of medical costs. Each year costs going up by 12 to 15%, and you know, you watch these insurance companies, and you know, people call me all day long and they tell me, Joe, I just got my rate renewal. They're going up 30%. And Joe, they're going up 50%, 70%. It's just unbelievable. People are shell shocked. And but you know, it's not just the cost of services going up. It's the fact that the American people are so unhealthy, they are so lost on this thing, that they're just needing medical care more than ever before. And you know, I believe I sent you an article where I quoted the American Medical Association and the World Health Organization. They have stated, the U.S. is in the worst epidemic of chronic and degenerative disease that mankind has ever known. And you know, people are often saying this today about America, that we are the most overfed and undernourished people on the face of the earth. We are literally killing ourselves. We are so wealthy. We can buy food all day long, processed, refined. You know, I've heard that 40% of the American food dollar is now spent at restaurants. And, of course, you and I both know that a lot of that is at the fast food places where it's just a very high-fat, low-fiber offering.
All right. How can people get in touch with you?
My phone number, we have a toll-free. It's 800-268-2514. And we've got a staff of people here. This is just a regional office here, but we can handle the calls here. And then send them the materials that they will need to carefully examine our program and see if it's for them.
All right, that's 1-800-268-2514. Mm-hmm. Now, you are part of the American Evangelical Association?
Yeah, the American Evangelistic Association is our parent organization, and the 501c3 that we directly work for is the Christian Care Ministry out of Melbourne, Florida, and it is a 501c3 under the American Evangelistic Association.
All right, fine. Now, a lot of the missionaries are covered by this?
Yes, we have people from all walks of life. Probably our leading class of joiner are the self-employed people. Obviously, those folks are on their own. We're talking farmers, ranchers, contractors. We get them all. Insurance agents. You know, in fact, our biggest source of referrals are Christian insurance agents because they know our program is pretty comprehensive, and there's no way that secular insurance can compete with it. We get medical doctors, dentists, lawyers, CPAs, and of course we do get a lot of pastors and missionaries, but many of those folks do have a denominational program. However, it's happening a lot now that we're having pastors call us and telling us that their denominational program is cracking and it's breaking and it's and they're going to drop it because no one can afford it.
Well, because what happens is, you know, they will get maybe 1,000 people into a program,
sure,
and it'll be a sort of a pool. But if a couple of those get very seriously ill, maybe one of them has to have a heart transplant, and two or three of them, you know, will have a cancer. Pretty soon, they begin to drain off of the funds, and so then they have to raise the price. And then, as they raise the price on that, why people begin to drop out, or the only people who stay in are those with serious illnesses. And then, of course, they drain off more funds until eventually, why, of course, the prices get so high that the insurance company protects itself by making it impossible for anybody to maintain the insurance, and that's the way the game is played.
Yeah.
Now, what about your company that carries the $50,000 to $5 million? Who is that? Do you know?
That's Odyssey Reinsurance, Stanford, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. All right, and have they had to raise their rates, or are they holding pretty steady?
They have done good. They did give us a raise in the rates this last January, but that's to be expected because of medical inflation. The nice thing was that our ministry, we've done really well on the educational effort and on the discounting, getting hospitals to give us discounts and so forth. And so we were able to absorb that increase that they gave us, and we've not had to increase the share this winter.
Now, what do you do then? You just have somebody call the hospital and explain them the situation. And of course, you know, a lot of the hospitals really, if they're approached, will actually cut the bill.
Yes, they will. And as you know, if you pay very quickly, they will make even nicer cuts. You know, so where we can, we want to be stewards of God's money. And I'm not involved in that part at all. That's the what you would call more or less the claims department, but we have worked with them. We explained to them that for many of our people, we are a safety net, that without us, there wouldn't be anything affordable. It's either us or nothing.
Well, of course,
when they understand that because of our ethic and our strong educational effort and motivational effort to get people to depart from unhealthy lifestyles and live healthier lives and, you know, keep the monthly share modest, And they see that we're providing a safety net for a lot of people who otherwise would not be able to afford it. It does tend to motivate them to say, okay, this is good, this is worthwhile, and we'll support this kind of a movement.
Well, is there anything else out there right now similar to what you have? You mentioned that there are other groups that, well, in fact, that was not what I originally thought that you were when you called me, that you were one of these where everybody sends their money in. This month you'll send your money to Joe Padeau over there in Pomona. Are those still going? Are those, because I was a little worried about some of those programs. Are they still there?
Yes, some of those were just a little bit too informal. they were... you know, the one that you're referring to, they were actually my introduction and into this whole thing in 1988. See, I had been in the insurance business since 79 and was doing a lot of health insurance and became very frustrated when I saw these rates going up and began to understand that it was lifestyle abuse that was funneling these large increases in the rates. And so I began looking around, and then through Brother Bill Gothard, which some of your listeners may know of, he has a Bible teaching ministry and out of the Chicago area, but he had discovered the Brotherhood newsletter and another program, The Good Samaritan, and I became familiar first with Brotherhood and then with Good Samaritan, but I was a little bit concerned too. It was just a let me just say, I was not sure about the management, and after a while, I got a chance to work with the Good Samaritan program out of Indiana, and they were really good folks, very efficient. I actually enrolled about 1,800 families for them, and but then when the Clintons were running the country, they were just convinced that we were going to end up with nationalized Hillary care, and so they kind of panicked, and they I could see that coming, and they were decided to jump in the lap of an insurance company, and they turned their whole program into just an insurance program, and then it became age rated, and then they became much more expensive. So, but before that happened, I got a chance to work with MediShare, which is firmly focused on the idea that Christians need to stay out of the insurance thing and have accountability, and you know, do the kind of thing that we're doing.
Well, you know, really, I'm very impressed by what you say. I'll have to admit, I was a little skeptical, you know, when I first heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that convinced me, if you're part of the American Evangelical Association, why, you know, I figured you had to be pretty responsible. And, of course,
mm-hmm.
this is the way it really should be handled, you know, and certainly with a catastrophic insurance policy on top of that, you know, it's going to protect you from, you know, just the horrendous bills that can actually come.
Yeah, like these spinal cord injuries and so forth.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, of course, I hope you won't have too many of those. But, of course, the other thing, you're absolutely right. Good health care, eating right, exercising, doing all these things that probably I don't do. My wife feeds me pretty well, but I don't exercise as much as I should. But I'm sure you're probably constantly talking to people about what they should do to take care of themselves.
Yes. You know, we have, Doc, we have people every day call and they say, you know, I'm interested in your program, Joe, and really would like to join, but, you know, I have hypertension, and can I be accepted? And I say, well, sure. We enroll hypertensives, you know, people with high blood pressure all day long. It's just that I want you to know coming in that it is a pre-existing condition, and so you won't be, that area will not be something we will participate in until you reverse that condition. And then they proceed to kind of do a double take at the other end, and they start saying things like, well, you know, my doctor told me that it's hereditary, and it's not my fault. And, you know, I just will need medication the rest of my life. And you notice how the medical industry is tending to take personal responsibility away from people and say, well, you know, it's not your fault. You just stay on this medication, and everything will be hunky-dory. And what we tell them is, well, you know, you can believe your doctor if you want to. However, you don't have to, because there are thousands of people across the country who, even without their doctor's urging, on their own personal research or getting help from organizations like ours, they are reversing hypertension through a natural food diet, high fiber, getting rid of the fat and the refined foods, getting some vigorous exercise, all of which will help in losing some weight and strengthening their body, and pretty soon they don't need the medication anymore. And so we don't tell anybody just get off the medication. That would be irresponsible. But if they will get some advice, you know, the Bible says in abundance of counsel, abundance of counselors there is safety and there's wisdom. And so we encourage people to do that, and sure enough, we see a lot of people join our program, and with our help, and the information that we get to them from our wellness department, they reverse that hypertension, and to the point where they can go to a doctor and he agrees, gee, you don't have hypertension anymore, you don't need medication, and then we actually can, then they no longer have the pre-existing condition.
Well, of course, the problem with certainly hypertension is not the hypertension, it's the complications of hypertension,
mm-hmm.
the renal complications, the strokes, the heart
yeah.
attacks. That is, of course, where you get into trouble with that. So if I came in with hypertension, would you take care of the stroke, the high blood pressure, or the kidney problems that would inevitably result from the untreated hypertension?
Yes, my understanding is that we would be pretty specific there. If it's if you're having trouble with hypertension, then you haven't reversed it yet, and you came in with it, then it's pre-existing, so we would not be participating in costs of treatment for the hypertension specifically. But other things we would participate in. However, we try very hard to identify those folks in our ministry, in our membership, that are at risk, and just as you're pointing out, to show them that, hey, if you camp out there for too long with this hypertension, you are going to experience all these other problems, and you need to take care of this problem to save the rest of your organs, you know. And so we do make a pretty strong effort in that area.
Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts to our listeners?
Well, yes, I might just say this, that when we feel that America, just the very things you were saying earlier, Doc, it looks like the push is on to take our freedoms away in so many ways. And one way, of course, is through nationalized, socialized medicine. And as more and more Americans know less and less about how to eat and live, they're all too hurried and they're on the run, eating a fast food diet, destroying their health. They're becoming, turning themselves into invalids, really, that need constant health care, one thing after another. In 1960, the statistics I have are that 5% of the of the gross national product is all it took to pay America's medical bill, and today it's approaching 20%, and we can see within 15 years, probably, it'll be 25% unless God intervenes in some way or the American people wake up. And so we feel that we've got to get the attention of Christians first, that we should be able to see the handwriting on the wall, and we should have the wisdom through God's Word to understand the times and realize that if Americans do not strengthen themselves and get a hold of themselves, we will become a nation of invalids that are dependent upon the state.
Well, I think you put it very well. God bless you, and I wish you the best. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet, Doc. Thanks so much for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Good night.
Mm-hmm. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Joe Foreman. Again, the number is 800-268-2514. That's 1-800-268-2514. And, of course, this is the time when I just want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And then if you'd, of course, like to join the Radio Liberty family, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, I'd suggest our March newsletter. It will certainly give you a very good understanding of the fact we're moving into World War III, that Iraq is just the first in a series of long-planned wars that, of course, designed to lead us into World War III. And, of course, if you'd like to get a copy of our newsletter, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's the March newsletter. And then please pray for America. Pray for our leaders, our ministers. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, I guess Thursday at the same time, may the Lord be with you.
Korea.